It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong and challenges to Beijing. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Not since 1989, when the Tiananmen Square protests in China met with a massive and bloody crackdown, have China's leaders seen anything like the anti-government demonstrations in Hong Kong. The protests, referred to as the Umbrella Revolution, began around September 26th, after the Chinese government announced a decision in late August that candidates for the post of the territory's chief executive should be selected by a committee stacked with Communist Party supporters. Several protest movements, the best known of which is called Occupy Central, along with students both from universities and schools, are calling for the party to honor the promise of democracy that was made when the British transferred the territory to China in 1997. Their main demand is that people of Hong Kong be allowed to vote for any candidate of their choosing in elections for the post of chief executive in 2017. This would be the first in which citizens would have such a vote. They are also demanding that the Beijing-appointed chief executive, CY Leung, step down. However, China's president, Xi Jinping, has made clear that he does not want any Western-style democracy within China's borders. This, even though Beijing promised the city a high degree of autonomy for 50 years. Beijing calls this one country, two systems. The impact and outcome of the protests are still unknown. Hong Kong authorities have canceled talks with pro-democracy protesters occupying parts of the city after they vowed to step up civil disobedience. The protest leader said increased pressure was needed ahead of the talks to ensure progress toward direct elections. Beijing has been very keen on keeping the protests under wraps, censoring Chinese media to keep mainlanders unaware and uninvolved. Well, for more on what triggered the so-called Umbrella Revolution and its potential impact on both Hong Kong and Beijing, we turn to two distinguished analysts. David M. Lampton is professor and director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington. He's the author of the recently published book, Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. Also joining us is Dean Chang. He's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. And that's a think tank based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, David M. Lampton, often known as Mike, we'll refer to you as David, here for our purposes. I'd like to get your reaction to this protest movement. We know it's not monolithic. There are some in Hong Kong who perhaps are not with the students and others who are protesting. Talk about what triggered the movement and how the authorities reacted.
Well, I think there are two broad triggers. One is what you might say a sort of cultural clash between popular perception and opinion on mainland China and that of locals who live in Hong Kong. And there have been lots of people from the mainland coming into Hong Kong, special administrative region, buying milk, taking up spaces in the hospital, driving up property prices. So there's a lot of resentment in Hong Kong against the mainland for reasons that have little to do with the politics, actually. And lots of resentment to the mainlanders who think their cousins in Hong Kong aren't very welcoming. And there's a body of opinion in the PRC that says Hong Kong people have it too good. So there's that kind of dynamic. Then there's the political, and this is, in some sense, a democracy movement. But it's complicated because Beijing thinks it's actually moved forward having a popular election, what they would call universal suffrage, in 2017. Beijing sees that as a move forward, but it's not enough to the people of Hong Kong, or at least the people in the streets, which I think represents a lot. And that is because the election will only be able to be among people that are vetted by a large nominating committee. And so the PRC, I think, sees this as a step forward, having an election at all, but it's insufficient for the people of Hong Kong because they will have it circumscribed who they can even vote for.
Turning to you, Dean Chang, very interesting points by David M. Lampton. We have the disconnect between those in Hong Kong vis-a-vis the mainland. They're not very happy about some of the mainlanders coming in, taking jobs, housing, and so on. But there's also this political issue. They want their elections in 2017 to be freer. So my question to you is, what was the agreement originally in 2017? Are the protesters who want these freer elections, are they taking it a step further? Or was the agreement really to have these so-called nominees for chief executive? Were they supposed to be vetted? And now the protesters are saying, well, that's just not good enough.
Well, I think what we are seeing here is the maturing of China's ability to play legal games almost as well as the U.S. does. The reality is that the joint declaration between the U.K. and China and then the subsequent basic law didn't say specifically exactly what would and wouldn't occur. The issue of
room for interpretation,
room,
then.
Plenty okay. of room for interpretation. The Chinese government, legally speaking, seems to actually be upholding its part of the agreement, which is universal suffrage. So if you are legally entitled to vote in Hong Kong, and they have a very consistent way of defining that, you will be allowed to vote. Where Beijing has stepped in is who you would be allowed to vote for. So it's a violation of the spirit of the agreement. But from a lawyer's perspective, I suspect, Beijing has both legs to stand on. Now, the issue here, unfortunately, politically, got really exacerbated because within this tension in June, Beijing issued a white paper on Hong Kong, their first. And here, they went much further. They basically said, one country, two system really is subordinating two systems to one country. And you, Hong Kong, first have to show that you are loyal to Beijing. And that really set everyone's teeth on edge so that when the declaration then came out that said, oh, and we're going to have this committee vet all of the candidates, it really made something of a mockery of one country, two systems. So that's why you see people like Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong, saying, this is not what we agreed to.
Well, turning back to you, David Mike Lampton, now we seem to be at a bit of a standoff here. Talk about the protesters themselves. To what extent do they represent the majority of Hong Kongers, so to speak? To what extent they are representative?
Well, first of all, the demonstrators in the street are not all students. There are what we'll call the old democracy movement, the people in their 50s and 60s that have been doing this for a long time, and there have been many protests before this current large-scale protest. So this is actually a heterogeneous movement, and they all are in the streets for different combinations of reasons. But broadly speaking, I would say the democracy motivation is a big motivation, and that without firm data, probably a majority of the people in Hong Kong sympathize with the idea of broadening out the electoral process. But if you think about it in interest group terms, there is the what you might call the very big business community in Hong Kong, what's often referred to as the tycoons, and they sent fairly recently a group to Beijing to talk to the central leadership. And these people want stability and a good business environment, and people in the streets shutting down the arteries are not a good business environment. So if you think about the distribution of interest group power in Hong Kong, the people favoring stability, as they would see it, are very powerful.
And when you say they're favoring stability, are they more on the side of the protesters, or are they leaning toward Beijing? Because it's hard to know.
Well,
where do they stand?
I don't want to say that all tycoons have exactly the same views,
sure,
but they have similar views. And I think their view would be rather like Dean Chung just articulated, is that actually Beijing moved forward in having universal suffrage election in narrow construction, and that, of course, we do want to continue to move forward in the future. But this is a step forward, and therefore, we ought to recognize the progress Beijing's made and push maybe for some compromise on the nominating committee and how that's going to happen. But in the end, I think the business community wants to get the people off the streets at the lowest possible cost to political concession.
Turning to you, Dean Chung, for your characterization of those in the streets in Hong Kong, the various groups represented.
I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that when students protest in any Chinese context, it is enormously important because it brings up memories of things like Tiananmen. Students taking to the streets are not protesting over the quality of food in the dining halls. They are serving truly as, in many ways, the conscience of the nation. And no government can really ignore students taking to the street. That being said, it is more than students. It is workers. It is the broader population. Unfortunately for the protesters, one of the contradictions that has emerged is by shutting down much of central Hong Kong, the shopkeepers, the small restaurant owners and the like are the ones who are being hurt. Mm-hmm. And so what has happened is that you have driven a wedge between those who were manning the barricades and those whose shops, storefronts, etc., were blocked off by those same barricades. So I think that's one of the reasons why the New York Times and other places have been reporting that the number of protesters of any sort has been steadily declining over the last few days.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are David M. Lampton. He's professor and director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington, and author of the recently published book, Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. And Dean Chung. He's senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. And we are talking about the historic pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong and its immediate and long-term implications for both Hong Kong and China. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Al-Kasim Awali from Adamawa State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, David M. Lampton, to talk about to what extent you see this as a test for Chinese President Xi Jinping. What kind of reaction are we getting from Chinese, both positive or negative?
Well, I think the beginning of understanding is to recognize Xi Jinping has an overloaded agenda. He's got enormous challenges internally, an anti-corruption campaign aimed at some of the most powerful economic and political networks in China. He's trying to reform the economy, and he, almost a year ago, issued 60 points of reform that focused on changing the economy very fundamentally. He's got environmental problems and the world clamoring about climate change, and China, the largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. This is a man who needs no more problems. And then along comes the Hong Kong situation, and it's not particularly of his making, but I think it'd be fair to say that he's recovered if things continue to de-escalate. And of course, as Mao Zedong said, a single spark can start a prairie fire. So anything could happen in Hong Kong. Whether it'll stay on its de-escalation mode remains to be seen. But if this continues to calm down, I think you'd have to count it as a victory for Xi.
So turning to you, Dean Chung, to what extent do you think this is a test for Chinese President Xi Jinping? He has a lot on his plate. This is the last thing he probably would like to see, but nonetheless, he has to deal with it. What about the Chinese reaction?
This is in many ways Xi Jinping's first crisis. There have been the issues with the Senkakus. There's been the issue of the oil rig in the South China Sea between China and Vietnam. But in many ways, these were crises that, one, China had a large hand in precipitating, and two, China really could control. If it wanted to, it could intercept more aircraft in the East China Sea air defense identification zone, or not. Hong Kong bubbled up from below. Mm-hmm. And that means that this is the first crisis where Xi could not automatically say, I can dial up or dial down the intensity. That makes this very important, and I think that's one of the reasons why a peaceful resolution of this, where Beijing and the Hong Kong authorities don't have to step back from their position, does in fact make this a win for Xi. It's still a little early in the process, but again, if the trend continues, that's the situation. That in turn has implications for how the audience in China will respond. A win for Xi will be seen by the broader population as evidence of Xi as a strong leader. I'm not so sure that Xi actually is a strong leader. Perception can differ from reality as much in China as it sometimes does here in the U.S. One of the things to keep in mind is that Xi is going to have to replace much of the top leadership at the 19th Party Congress in 2017. So unlike previous Chinese leaders Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, he actually has to be thinking about, in a sense, a midterm election, which has not happened before, because he is going to want his people moved onto the Politburo and the Politburo Standing Committee. In this sort of situation, having Hong Kong be a festering sore would be the last thing he would want. And conversely, a peaceful resolution where Hong Kong accepts the dictates of the National People's Congress and of the CCP would absolutely be a huge win for him.
Turning back to you, David M. Lambton, so what do you think would both pacify the protesters in Hong Kong and also be acceptable to China? Do you see some sort of middle ground?
Well, in theory, I see a compromise that could be made, or at least the outlines of one. Of course, there's the reality that there are different groups, different voices. So this is a huge problem. The people in the streets seem to be demanding resignation of the chief executive, I think not going to happen. And they want universal suffrage, as Dean explained it, meaning also control over the nomination of who is going to run. I think that is a non-starter because the National People's Congress in Beijing issued the regulations. And even according to the agreements with the British, the National People's Congress is the sovereign authority here in the end. So I don't see Xi or the Chinese agreeing on either of the major demands. But there are compromises that could be made, and I would urge Beijing to think seriously how those could be adopted. One is to say, well, we carry on the 2017 election, but paint a roadmap beyond that would involve increasing degrees of involvement in genuine universal suffrage elections. That's one approach. Another is to say, well, we're going to have a nominating committee, but maybe we can change the rules by which the nominating committee operates so that you don't need a 51% or 50+% vote to nominate somebody. Or maybe you enlarge the nominating committee to include new constituencies. So I think it's eminently feasible in theory to have a compromise, but whether the students and the others are organized to be able to agree legitimately to accept a compromise and whether they're predisposed to do so, I don't know.
Turning to you, Dean Chung, and then we don't know to what extent they, that is the protesters, the students, the middle class shopkeepers, those who are in favor of some kind of change, is there an interlocutor that all agree will speak on their behalf? And there's that question. And then, of course, what are your thoughts with regard to some kind of a compromise?
The protests were remarkably well organized from a technical perspective. Water stations, first aid stations, handing out umbrellas to counter pepper spray. But in terms of organization, this was perhaps somewhat more typical of student behavior in the sense that there were several people who seemed to have been deputized as spokespeople, but not so much leaders. The more traditional pro-democracy leadership, of course, has also been part of the spokesmanship and all that, but I'm not sure that they count as decision makers. And at the end of the day, how do you get the word out to everyone that an agreement has been reached or not? This is always one of the problems with social media driven and organized entities, is some people don't always get the message. With regards to a compromise, it is interesting to note that there have now emerged a few news stories about CY Lung and whether or not he is the ideal person to continue to be the chief executive of Hong Kong. I'm not in a position to judge whether these stories are accurate or not, but it is interesting the timing, particularly since some of these seem to be sourced from Chinese media, and those media sources still operate under a fair amount of tight state control, which does suggest that somebody like the chief executive is not going to resign because of the protests, but he may be thrown under a passing bus or tram.
Metaphorically only,
let me emphasize that. In the context of finding some kind of face-saving resolution for all this, I also would note here that the next election after 2017 would be 2022, when you would also have a new Chinese leadership in Beijing. If ever there was an opportunity to potentially shuffle the entire deck without anyone being seen as losing face or having made concessions, it would be making 2022 a period when we're going to have a new leadership in Beijing. They are not necessarily going to have to be bound by any decisions by this current administration in Beijing, and certainly there would be a new leadership slate potentially available in Hong Kong, especially if, as David suggested, some really interesting ways about the nominating committee procedures and composition.
Well, turning back to you, David Michael Lambton, these compromises, for example, that you are advocating or enunciating seem very reasonable, but then the reality, we have to see if, in fact, something like this is possible and what the impact would be. And what about opposition political supporters in Hong Kong's legislature? They seem to be gunning for the impeachment of the chief executive, CY Leung, and seem to be taking the side of these protesters.
Of course, the local legislative body in Hong Kong has actually, even under the British, been a legislative body that often finds itself at loggerheads with the executive, whoever the executive is, like legislatures around the world.
Good point.
And so in that sense, you have a functioning political system that's quite recognizable. I think the Legislative Council will want to arrive at a compromise in the end that avoids bloodshed, because any application of force or coercion in Hong Kong is going to be bad for the economy of Hong Kong, which the legislature also represents, and it will obviously be bad for civil liberties and immediate human rights issues. So I think the legislature, in the end, wants something that they can see as pushing in the democratic direction, but in the end will probably support a compromise.
And Dean Cheung, anything to add or subtract regarding the legislature?
It's important to also remember that the legislature is itself often picked and certainly is heavily influenced by Beijing. There are democratic elements on there, but Beijing stacked that particular deck just as it wants to stack the deck of who you get to vote for chief executive. So it is striking, therefore, when the legislative body is in fact making noises in favor of democracy. It suggests that there is some level of recognition from Beijing that they may not be able to simply impose an absolute solution here.
Back to you, David M. Lampton. Talking about Hong Kong's very special role in the world, in a way, but also for China. We know that China's state-owned firms began to list on the territory's stock exchange as a way to raise capital. Many of China's biggest state-run banks, energy giants, and telecommunications operators are listed in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is very important for China. Talk about how this will affect how Beijing deals with this very important test case.
Well, if you think about the influence and importance of 7 million people in Hong Kong, this is a big but medium-sized big city for China. So one place with 7 million people has enormous importance and impact in a number of dimensions for 1.3 billion people. Certainly, one area of impact is the credibility of China's leadership. When all is said and done, the arrangements surrounding Hong Kong were international agreements in some portion, to the degree they were negotiated with Britain, most obviously. The United States passed a Hong Kong Policy Act that certainly the Chinese don't accept the legitimacy of that, but it's an expression of interest that the United States has in this. So if things go south, so to speak, in Hong Kong, you're going to find reaction in legislatures, not least the U.S. Congress, around the world. And China doesn't need more problems there. So that's one whole area of interest. Right. Financial markets. Hong Kong has been probably the biggest single source of foreign direct investment coming from Hong Kong. That is very important to China. And some of the uncertainties surrounding China and a recent, at least, decline in the growth rate of foreign direct investment in China means China wants to bolster, I think, the confidence that exists in international markets among investors. So that's all very important. Also, there are agreements between Hong Kong and central bureaucracies and local bureaucracies. You can kind of look at Hong Kong in a way as an administration think tank for many organizations in China, helping them develop their legal and court system, administrative measures, how you have urban development. There are cross-border agreements on environmental protection and so forth. So I think it's really quite extraordinary how important these 7 million people are to China overall. But don't misunderstand, if in the end Beijing feels that this is an issue of control and credibility of the Communist Party, those other interests will recede as determinants of behavior.
So back to you, Dean Cheung. There's a lot at stake here over what we're seeing, this crisis for China in Hong Kong, reconciling their need for stability for the world. Hong Kong is an international market for them and for others, foreign direct investment, but also the need for China to keep a lid on things, keep the party's grip on the situation. How do you see China reconciling these disparate needs and interests?
Well, one of the areas where, in fact, this outbreak has already led China to be a loser is with regards to Taiwan. The declaration embodied in the white paper on Hong Kong, the National People's Congress, has put very, very strong limitations on one country, two systems. One country, two systems is the policy that Chinese leaders have proffered to Taipei for the last 40 years. And Hong Kong is going to be the petri dish. Hong Kong is going to be the test case. Now that we have these formal statements saying one country, two systems means one country, and your other system will operate within tight limits, Taipei, not surprisingly, is going to look at this, and they have an upcoming election where Beijing does not get to determine the slate in 2016. I suspect that this is going to roil those waters significantly. The financial aspect, the IMF, of course, this week announced that China may have equaled or surpassed the U.S. in terms of GDP levels, in purchasing power parity terms at least. So China is looking at potentially becoming the number one economy in the world in the next several years. Hong Kong is a world-class financial center. It's the only one at this point in China. Ruining its credibility, which a violent suppression would do, would be a massive blow to Beijing's ability to project the aura of we are the number one economy in the world. So how this gets resolved is enormously important.
Well, gentlemen, we will continue to discuss the significance and impact of what's going on in Hong Kong for China. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, David M. Lampton. He's professor and director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Dean Chung. He's senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both, gentlemen, for your terrific insights.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having us.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.